No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Tonight we have a very special guest, William Rugger. Mr. Rugger is an expert on the Middle East, and he's going to talk to us. I'm sorry we're late, folks. We're coming on a few minutes late. But he's going to talk to us about the current situation, and we're excited to have him with us tonight. Let me just point out before I introduce Maria and before we go any further that on our statehood news, which is on this date in 1988, a time capsule was buried in Freedom Plaza across the street from my office and in front of the Capitol, which contained the clerical robes of Dr. Martin Luther King, his Bible, and a 51-star flag, in the hopes that when it's opened in 2088, the District of Columbia will be a state. So we just wanted to point that out. It's a momentous occasion for us. It's the 32nd anniversary of when that time capsule was buried. But that being said, welcome, Maria.
Thank you, Michael. And happy new year to our listeners.
Yeah, happy new year. I forgot that we hadn't been on since
December 29th with Joe Madison, which was a fabulous conversation.
It was. And tonight we're going to have a fabulous conversation
also
with William Rugger. Mr. Rugger, are you with us? Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's going to be a good time to talk about Middle East politics for sure.
Yeah.
I would like to make one clarification. It's Dr. William Rugger. My understanding is you have your PhD in politics from Brandeis University.
I do indeed.
Well, Dr. And I'm just getting mine, so I know what that means. So I just want to just give you the kudos that you deserve. Thank you. Not to mention that you're vice president for research and policy at the Charles Koch Institute.
So tell us, Mr. Rugger. Listen, that's right. Thank you, Maria, for pointing all that out. We're so happy to have Mr. Rugger in and. So let's start right at the top. You know, last Thursday, a week ago Thursday, President Trump gave the orders to take out Mr. Soleimani. That was followed by 20 missiles being fired at a U.S. base. That was followed by the downing of a Ukrainian airliner. And that's been followed by massive protests in Iran. So where do we stand right now, Mr. Rugger? Where are we in diplomacy and our relationship with Iraq and Iran?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, the immediate crisis eased, right? So one could have expected, under different conditions, one could have expected a continuation of the relatively quick escalation that we had been seeing. I mean, and again, part of this, one of the things that's important to remember is this is going back a ways now. So while there was the immediate issue when it came to the killing of the U.S. contractor, followed by the embassy protests and the killing of General Soleimani, the fact is that It goes further back when the maximum pressure campaign of the administration really kicked off, including getting the U.S. Out of the JCPOA. And this maximum pressure campaign has led to an escalatory spiral. In fact, the maximum pressure campaign is an escalation. And what we've seen is we've seen responses and counter responses, including those tankers that were hit in the Gulf and the Saudi fuel facility, gasoline facility in the Gulf. And so one of the interesting things here and scary things here is that we've seen this escalation in the relationship. And the maximum pressure campaign is still going on. So that's why I say we've had a bit of an ease of the immediate crisis. But I still think that overall, there's really a challenge here to U.S.-Iranian relations, and it could continue to get hot. In fact, we could expect, given the maximum pressure campaign, we could expect further crises ahead.
Well, first of all, thanks for pointing that out, because everybody out there talking on the air right now is talking about Soleimani forward. Nobody's talking about what happened earlier, and that, you know, and past is prologue. So thanks for filling in the blanks for us. But given what happened today, there was an attack today on an airbase in northern Iraq. Is that a continuation of this maximum pressure campaign and the response from the Iranians?
Well, I haven't seen whether it's been confirmed that this actually came from someone with orders from Iran or from a close proxy. So I'm not sure, and we should be careful in ascribing it to that central direction just yet. But again, I think the thing is, like I said, to remember is that this is part of an escalatory spiral. And the danger here is that the maximum pressure campaign and the responses to it could lead to an actual war. In fact, it could put President Trump in a box, whether he likes it or not, right? So you can imagine a situation in which this campaign, fomented by his advisors, in some ways, you could say in contradiction to his desire to kind of end endless wars, as he's been talking about, could lead to something that maybe he doesn't want. Now, who knows what he actually wants? But the fact is, at least from what he's been stating, it doesn't seem he's all that eager to fight a war against Iran. He's eager, it seems to be, have an instinct that we should be getting out of the Middle East rather than sinking deeper into it. But again, I think a lot of his advisors have been promoting policies that are actually going to potentially box him in. And I think that's quite dangerous for the United States. And one other thing I'd want to add here is that despite what I said about this being part of an escalatory spiral, the fact is that the Iranians aren't exactly, lacking in any problems themselves. I mean, General Soleimani is someone who no one should mourn. And while there's a lot of complications from his killing, again, it's not as if this was someone who is a mere innocent who was targeted by the United States. So I think you could disagree with the types of policies that the United States is pursuing while not necessarily mourning the loss of this, leader of a regime that I have no sympathy for, that is Iran.
Well, I have to agree with you there. My first employer was President Jimmy Carter, and we worked through the hostage crisis. I mean, I joined his campaign in 1980, and every day we looked at the hostage crisis, the Iranian hostage crisis. So there's no love lost on my end. Maria, do you have a question for
Dr. Rugger, I'm curious what your thoughts are about the fact that it was a Ukrainian airline that had a large majority of Iranian passengers on it, and that it was an accident, but it's also creating Iranian protests based on the deaths of their own people.
Yeah, I mean, the Iranian regime is having difficulty with its mass appeal. And there are those within Iran who would clearly like to see the Ayatollah go, right? you know, that being said, you know, there's also the case that there were a lot of supporters, particularly after the Soleimani killing. And so I think what you have in Iran is a lot of different groups and individuals both wanting to stand behind the regime when it's being hit by outsiders, but also concerned about, you know, there are those who are concerned about the future of Iran. And maybe wanting a different approach, particularly given how the Iranians had denied what had happened at first. And so it looked pretty bad to the Iranian people and to the world, actually, when they fessed up. And so, you know, Iranian politics is fraught with difficulties ahead. And this is one of the things that we should really worry about as well, is what happens when a regime that really feels quite threatened in terms of its regime survival, what does it do? And again, with the maximum pressure campaign, one can imagine the Iranians faced with one of two things, right? Either they can submit to what the United States wants it to do, or it can actually try to break out of the box and do something to do, you know, to make that happen. And one worries about what that could be. I doubt it would be, you know, the same kind of direct thing we've seen in history, when states have been boxed in with really difficult choices, you know, it could still be something that you know, redounds against the United States. And that's why I think we have to think about in our whole policy here is, what is the United States' chief interest? Why are we there and doing this? Why is the maximum pressure campaign going on? And is it necessary for our interests? And there I would go back to say, hey, our interest in the Gulf is making sure that there's no long-term disruptions to the flow of oil that could impact the global economy. And we want to make sure that terrorist groups with the intent and capability to hit the United States or its forces, that can't happen. But I'm not sure that actually trying to push for regime change in Iran is necessary for either of those goals. In fact, you could argue that this campaign against Iran is actually undermining some of those goals. And therefore, again, I think we really ought to think about whether we're approaching the Middle East the right way and whether we need a rethink to our Middle East policy.
And, I mean, couldn't you say the exact same thing that you just said? Couldn't you say that about the American political situation, too, that we have a president that needs to be reelected and that it doesn't bode well for a de-escalation to have this situation, you know, just like the Iranians might want to keep, you know, from changing regimes, so might the Republicans, rather, and so might the president. So does that doesn't bode well, does it? If there's an escalation on the Iranian side, won't we have to escalate on our side? Won't there be pressure to escalate on our side just so the president looks good?
Well, it's not just because the president wants to look good. It's also because in these escalatory spirals, in a certain sense, it becomes rational to push back to the actors themselves. Right. And that's what's so dangerous about this. And that's why that we need an off-ramp here, if you believe, like I do, that a war with Iran would be unnecessary and imprudent for our interests. In fact, it would go quite against those. And that's why I think we should find an off-ramp. And in some sense, in the immediate sense, that's what President Trump gave us by not responding the way you could have imagined, right, you know, in response to those strikes that we saw by the Iranians. I think the key here, though, is that there was only a slight, you know, off-ramp, an off-ramp of the immediate, because, you know, in that speech that he gave the next day, the problem is that he also talked about ratcheting up the sanctions, keeping the maximum pressure campaign on, in effect, and that's going to lead, in fact, it may promise further problems, and so he didn't completely get off that, but that speech was a lot to a lot of people, right? There was obviously something to his hawkish advisors. There was something to his base that don't want another war in the Middle East. And there was also something to the diplomacy angle. And you saw that with some call for that. Now, the question is which of these different aspects or impulses in the Trump administration is he going to go with? And myself, I'm hoping that just like he tried to do with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, that maybe he breaks out of the cycle through an attempt at some kind of personal diplomacy, or at least pushing for something different than what we've seen traditionally in U.S.-Iranian relations.
Since you use the terms, Dr. Ruger, unnecessary and imprudent, are you or the Charles Koch Institute ever solicited for your opinion to the White House?
Well, I mean, we're happy to give our opinion to anyone who'll listen. So we're more than happy to let people know what we're thinking, and including your listeners here tonight. I tell you, one of the things that's really interesting about what's happening in town right now, despite this crisis, is that there is more interest in the approach that focuses on realism about the nature of the world and restraint in how we engage in it. So realism and restraint is kind of hot right now, and it's not actually partisan, right? It's a transpartisan or bipartisan movement that you're seeing. And so you see groups like the Quincy Institute, which I think is a really exciting new progressive or more progressive force, and then in groups like Defense Priorities. And these are all promoting a new vision, a different vision for American foreign policy than we've seen over the last 30 years. And largely that's in response to too many unnecessary and imprudent conflicts foisted on the American people and the taxpayers by either Republicans or Democrats. So again, it's not just picking on, say, President Obama for the disastrous war against Libya. It's also George W. Bush for probably what is the biggest disaster in American foreign policy in my lifetime.
Well, that's, I certainly have to agree with you, Dr. Ruger, that we're seeing a new attitude emerge, and that's a positive sign. But let me ask you, if you were the guy, to follow up on what Maria said, if I came to you and said, what does the off-ramp look like? What does your off-ramp look like? What do you think we need to do to make that off-ramp viable politically, both for the Iranians and the Americans?
Well, I think you would need someone that could bring partners from around the globe, similar to what the JCPOA did, the mm-hmm. What is known as the Iran deal did. But obviously, President Trump, given that he got the United States out of that deal and was not very happy with it, and oftentimes on the campaign trail and since he became president, was very critical of President Obama. So I think what you really need to have is you probably need to have something like it, but that is different enough that President Trump can say he's for it and that it's better than what President Obama got. Now, look, the reason why the deal was the way it was because that was probably the best that could have been gotten at the time, given the need to get allies and even strategic competitors on board. But, look, perhaps given the fact that the Iranians would know that any escalation of this conflict further could, ultimately be even worse for them than maybe taking something that's like a JCPOA plus, maybe they'd be willing to go for that. But I think what I would do is really push on the diplomatic front and have it be real diplomacy. I mean, one of the problems with American diplomacy of late, and I don't think this is particular to President Trump, but also President Obama and President Bush, is that a lot of our diplomacy has been really like, hey, we'll be happy to negotiate your surrender. We'll be happy to negotiate for you to give us everything we want. I think the JCPOA was a little bit different, but I think that's been one of the problems. And that's one of the reasons why there hasn't been really much movement or wasn't much movement in Afghanistan, for example, until recently, where you have seen diplomacy with Ambassador Khalilzad be more like the kind of true diplomacy that we often need. To make sure that we don't have to just use the military tool in the statecraft toolbox.
Well, let me ask you one thing that surprised me, and you're the expert, so I don't know if it surprised you, but I was very surprised that the Iranians stepped up to the plate and took responsibility for the Ukrainian airliner Did that surprise you? And what do you think that indicates? Do you think that indicates on their part a willingness to reopen negotiations and, you know, accept some of the responsibility for what's going on?
Well, I think in this case, they, you know, they were going to either have to have the world think that it was them and deny it in the face of that, you know, kind of like Baghdad Bob or something, or they were going to have to own up to it sooner rather than later. And I think they chose the latter option, you know, and unfortunately, this kind of thing happens when in conflicts, right? You know, Clausewitz, the famous Prussian strategist, talked about the fog of war, and so we see these types of things happen in warfare, and it's regrettable. And that's also one of the reasons why we need to de-escalate this conflict. And again, it would be one thing if this was something that was really necessary to America's safety or the conditions of our prosperity or the survival of our liberal democratic system here at home. But a conflict with Iran is really unnecessary. And it just reminds me of our approach to the Middle East for decades, right? We get into these unnecessary conflicts. We end up using military force, and bad things happen to the people we're ostensibly trying to help, and bad things happen to us. I mean, the Iraq War is lesson number one there, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know what? You give me great, you know, your attitude about all this gives me great hope. And let me tell you something. I studied Clausewitz in graduate school, and you're the first person I've ever heard quote him. So I have great faith in you. Maria?
Yes, I would like our listeners to have a perspective about your opinion and where it comes from. Can you frame it within what the Charles Koch Institute is and does? And how you go about what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Sure, and it fits quite directly. And so, you know, what we're interested in is, you know, trying to break the barriers that hold back people from realizing their potential. Whether that's criminal justice reform, where you see us really being a leader in trying to promote educational work around that issue, because of the fact that, you know, things like excessive sentencing or collateral consequences or, you know, over-criminalization or the, you know, militarization of policing. These things are all destructive of kind of the communities and of people, you know, being able to get their lives together. Even when they have committed a crime where they ought to go to prison, some of these excessive sentences are really destructive on them coming to getting back on the rung of success for their life and trying to avoid a life of crime. So that's one example, but foreign policy is another, right? You think about how our foreign policy impacts so many aspects of our life, and when we get it wrong, you know, then it really has deleterious consequences. I mean, think about the war in Iraq, a destructive, unnecessary war, you know, killed hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq, but think about America, you know, 4,000 American soldiers died there. In the whole global war on terror, we've had, what, over 50,000 wounded, and people are gone a lot from their families. I mean, think of, you know, that even happened to me. I mean, I'm in the Navy Reserve, and I was mobilized to Afghanistan in 2008, 2009. I was away from my family for a year, and while I am very proud of my service there and hope I helped with our mission, the fact is that my family had to suffer from that, and when it's necessary to do so, you don't feel so bad about it, right? It's just what you need to do to serve your country and to make your country safe. But when it's unnecessary, it's really, you know, quite a tragedy, quite a terrible thing, particularly for those who make the ultimate sacrifice. And so we think about war as being something that can be a real barrier to people's realizing their potential. And our society as a whole, if you think about what it leads to, you know, this goes all the way back to the founders, right? War making leads to excessive taxation. It leads to problems like our debt and deficit ballooning, and that's something that Admiral Mike Mullen was talking about when he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It leads to things like the surveillance state, which undermines, I think, our sense of trust in government. And so you see all these things that are really a kind of barrier to our potential as individuals and as society. And so it fits quite nicely, I think, into what we think about that.
And everything that I have read, it seems that your institute is nonpartisan. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we are not partisan in how we approach things. We work with people left, right, and center, conservative, progressive, libertarian, liberal, right? What we're really trying to do is we have a set of principles that guide how we think about the world, and we're excited to partner with people who want to find solutions to these barriers, to break them down with us, or for us to help support them in the great work that they're doing. And so, you know, whether that's on university campuses where, you know, in the foreign policy area, for example, we work with, you know, great universities and great scholars like Notre Dame, MIT, Harvard, Texas A&M, to support research that helps us understand the world around us, or whether it's, support, you know, kind of working with groups like the Quincy Institute. You know, I think it's pretty exciting the fact that we've been able to, for example, do work where we've had partners, Roe Khanna, for example, a progressive Democrat from Silicon Valley. We agreed on Yemen, and we, in our efforts, really tried to help educate people about the problems of our participation in that conflict, both for the people of Yemen who have suffered greatly and for our own interests. So I'm kind of excited. I mean, I'm super excited, as you could tell, about the kind of work we're trying to do, because we can foster these transpartisan coalitions and really educate people about how to break out of these problems.
You know, I have to say the things you're saying give me great hope. I think it really is a different approach to the way, at least as a civilian who's observed our foreign policy, it's certainly much different than our previous approach. Let me ask you, how are you finding, are you being well received? We're in such a situation in the United States right now where we're so divided. How are you, you know, how are you bridging that gap? Are people coming together around your approach on both sides of the aisle, on Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives? Are you finding acceptance for this new kind of rhetoric?
Well, we've done a lot of polling at the Charles Koch Institute on what people think about foreign policy, and the majority, even the supermajority in some instances, don't think that what we're doing in the world is necessarily making us or the world safer. And so I think there's a support for new ideas in that area. That being said, I mean, there is a real difference between what the foreign policy elite, you know, what Obama's aide Ben Rhodes called the blob, and what I think a lot of Americans, and certainly what I think about the nature of the world and what we should do in it. So really, this is where you have a mass elite disconnect between the foreign policy establishment, largely here in Washington, and the American public. And one of the things that's really, really, though, exciting is that you are seeing the emergence of a counter-elite, a new foreign policy thought leaders and public intellectuals that are offering a new vision. But I will tell you that the kind of status quo foreign policy establishment is not very excited about what the Charles Koch Institute or these other groups are doing, because of the fact that it's really pushing back against the old views. That being said, there are some members of the establishment that have been, I think, open-minded about this because they would like to see a more diverse marketplace of ideas. And even if they disagree with us, I think they want to have people like me and others that agree with a foreign policy of realism or restraint. I think they want to have them part of the conversation because they think it's important that we do so, especially given that a failure of having a good marketplace of ideas led to bad policies like the Iraq War.
I have to say that I've traveled over the last year. I've been to several international conferences, and they all have all revolved around things like resilience and world diplomacy. And I can tell you that people from other countries certainly want to embrace this as well. You know, they constantly come to me and ask for a new paradigm for American foreign policy. They're worried about what direction we're headed in. So I think you're certainly headed in the right direction. And it's good to know that there are people out there that are receptive of your ideas. Let's just hope we have more and more of that.
One interesting demographic that I'm not surprised of as a veteran, but I think others might be, would be surprised, seem pretty supportive of restraint, are veterans. The Pew has done some polling on this. I think the number was maybe 64% or 69% of vets would support a withdrawal from Afghanistan. You've seen other polling showing vets supportive of a different approach. And I think that's exciting because a lot of times, veterans are kind of key influencers with their peers and in their communities. And if veterans are willing to support a new approach, then I think more people would be, willing to do that, because a lot of people worry about the kind of sunk cost argument, right? Like if a veteran tells them, hey, I lost buddies on the battlefield, we have to keep going, I think a lot of Americans might give them the benefit of the doubt. But when veterans themselves are saying, hey, we really need to rethink this. Maybe it's not best for us to continue on, with people dying, all the time in Afghanistan. We just had two American service members killed just a couple days ago. I think a lot of vets are tired of that. They don't think it's honoring their sacrifice to actually have us continue to be fighting wars that are unnecessary, and where we're not having strategic success. And so I'm heartened by that, and there are a lot of groups out there. And we talked earlier about the kind of transpartisan or bipartisan approach. So one of the things that we've seen is Concerned Veterans for America, which is part of the Stand Together community, has aligned itself in terms of promoting this desire to end endless wars with Vote Vets, which is a progressive group. And they fought each other like cats and dogs over VA reform, for example, and they were on different sides of that, and that's understandable given their views. But the fact that they've been able to align together to promote an end to endless wars, I mean, this is kind of exciting, if you ask me, because especially in this era of polarization, you've seen, groups like Vote Vets say good things about President Trump. I mean, who would have thought?
All right.
Dr. Ruger, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention some of the opportunities that are available with the Charles Koch Institute, because I know that you offer like internships and associate programs, and you even have a journalism fellowship opportunity. Could you share with the listeners what those look like and how they might be able to get involved or to apply or to be accepted?
Yes, we do have educational programs at the Charles Koch Institute. And if you go to our website, charleskochinstitute.org, you can see some of those opportunities. They're exciting ones for people who are trying to get involved in the kind of social change business, that want to learn about how they can be more effective in breaking barriers. So that'd be great. One of the other things I think that people can stay tuned for are kind of future opportunities where we're going to hold events on foreign policy subjects, both in Washington and around the country. We have a great program where the Charles Koch Institute and the Brookings Institution actually hold debates around the country, largely on the question of what is America's proper role in the world. And we'll see more of those coming forward and bring that around the country. So there's all kinds of opportunities that I think are exciting to people. And again, if you go to the Brookings website, I think you can see some of these debates from the past, including one that I did on Russia just recently with Jim Goldgeier from American University and Brendan Green from Cincinnati and Molly Montgomery from here in Washington.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, I should have warned you, Dr. Ruger, to be careful what you say to Maria, because she's a perpetual student, and she'll be going for her third PhD through your organization. But let me put
something along those lines. I was invited by the University of Southern California to apply for a journalism fellowship, and the deadline was on Friday, so that's why that was on my radar, because I saw that you had one for journalists as well. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's even more opportunities out there.
Yeah, well, it's great when people are trying to kind of increase their education and hopefully then can can have a more positive impact on the world. And that's one of the reasons why I was a professor in my career, and now I'm doing what I'm doing now. Education is my life.
Nice.
Let's talk about veterans for a second. First of all, I'm remiss in not thanking you for your service. So thank you for your service,
yes,
sir. And let me ask you about veterans, because I remember, I'm old enough to remember when veterans stood up against the Vietnam War for several of the same reasons that you're saying veterans are standing up now. They were not well received. And actually, it followed many of them through their lives. You know, I worked on John Kerry's campaign, and he took a lot of grief for being part of Veterans Against the Vietnam War. Are veterans today who are standing up and saying that that war's not a good thing? Because personally, I believe that if you love veterans, the best thing you can do is keep them home. How do you feel about this? Are you getting resistance? Are veterans getting resistance from the old guard on these sorts of things?
Well, I don't think that there are that many people that are really invested in continuing in these endless wars. And so there's not a huge constituency outside of outside of the foreign policy establishment, here in Washington. And so, sure, there are a lot of, kind of retired brass or current brass who think we should continue. You know, General Petraeus thinks we need to fight generational war in Afghanistan. Ambassador Crocker thinks we should continue for, who knows how long into the future. But very few people, I think, out there are so invested outside of that elite that they're going to really push back. Sure, there are people who disagree with you, and that's fine. I mean, hey, we're in America. Everybody has the right to their own opinion. But the fact is that there hasn't been that pushback. In fact, there's a lot of veterans who have excitement around this because they agree with you. They don't think the way to honor people is to send them to unnecessary wars. And they've seen some of this. They've seen the waste. They've seen the deaths. They've seen the lack of a kind of strategic vision. And I'd really be remiss if I didn't bring up the Afghanistan papers that were, that the Washington Post broke that story about, recently, where it was very apparent that the people in charge have been letting down the average soldier because they have had no clue, really, about what to do. And it's really evident in those Washington papers. And I really recommend people look at that Washington Post article and what underlined it, because it's quite devastating about the elites and the establishment and our leadership for really letting us down.
Well, and thank you for bringing up the thing about families, because my brother was an F-111 pilot towards the end of the Vietnam War, but most of his career was during peacetime, and we worried about him every day he was in the cockpit. We worried about every mission he went on. And so, those that stay at home serve just as well in many instances. These are all our sons and daughters and husbands and wives and fellow citizens. So we're all in this together. And that idea that you seem to be promoting, that we're all in this together and that we all need to have, to take part in making sure we have a solid foreign policy, I think is really refreshing, and it's really something we need. But I don't want to monopolize your time. Maria, do you have another question?
I sure do. Right. I'm very curious about what your day-to-day experience is like doing what you do. Like, I have, these fantasies. You go into this room and you have people that are surrounding you, colleagues, like-minded, obviously bright, forward-thinking individuals, and you talk about how we're going to save the world, or we're going to make these social changes, or we're going to help break these barriers that are keeping people back, which I think must be incredibly stimulating. But is my fantasy incorrect?
Well, I think what's really the kind of thing that gets a lot of the people that work at the Koch Institute and at a sister organization, the Charles Koch Foundation, I think what gets them so excited is actually the kind of quality of partners that we have. And so it's not just that we're working with people in our own building who are excited about these ideas, but we're working with people all over the country. I mean, And, you know, the foundation supports hundreds of university programs in a variety of subjects, including foreign policy and criminal justice reform and tech and innovation and free speech. I mean, that's exciting. But also here in Washington, I mean, I've really enjoyed our partnership with the Brookings Institution for this debate series, both as a participant on stage, but also in helping shape this so it could be a successful program. You know, working with, you know, helping, you know, young, you know, scholars get a chance through some of the philanthropy that we do. You know, going to events in town and speaking on these issues. So I was recently at the Center for the National Interest that's here in Washington to talk about our policy towards North Korea. And that was a lot of fun because there are a lot of great people and individuals that are quite talented, and being able to interact with them and learn from them, I think, you know, jazzes up a lot of us. You know, and finding people excited about this vision and working with them towards that.
So do you actually have opportunities not only once you identify potential partners or selected, and like say the Quincy Institute that you mentioned, do you have an ability to put teeth into decisions that you make, i.e. legislation or lobbying or policy changes? How does that work?
Well, the Charles Koch Institute and the Charles Koch Foundation are 501c3 educational organizations, so they cannot, they don't do any lobbying, and so that's not something that we do at the Koch Institute. But we do educational work with a lot of people. You know, like I said before, in response to your question, we're happy to talk to anyone on these subjects because we're trying to educate, right? You know, that I think that's what's, you know, kind of a continuation of my career as from being a professor. I mean, I spent most of my life as a professor and then only came to the Koch Institute when offered an opportunity to try to get engaged, you know, with this fight that I've been talking about. So, you know, to me, it's really about helping people understand, like we talked about, what is realism? What is restraint? You know, why should we take those lessons of Clausewitz and apply it to our foreign policy? How do we think about history and how that impacts, you know, what we think about the world of the future? So that's kind of, like I said, I think it's really just a continuation of that academic career that I thought I would do for my whole life before I came to Koch.
Well, let me ask you, you know, and, you know, it's a funny coincidence. My F-111 flying brother got a doctorate in education and just retired as president of a college. So it seems that there's a lot of veterans out there trying to educate themselves and make things better. But your approach to me seems so rational. Why do you think it's taken us so long to come around to this?
Well, I think part of it is that the United States, as a liberal country, and I don't say that in the kind of liberal, like, you know, Mike Dukakis, right, you know, but as a liberal country generally, whether that's classical liberal or modern liberal, I think there's a lot of impulses towards wanting to remake the world. You know, it goes back to, you know, right at the beginning, this idea of a novo ordo seclorum, right, a new order for the ages. And what the founders wanted to do was to try to perfect our experiment in liberty and democracy here at home, and they really wanted us to stay out of the kind of old world with its, you know, kind of where you had the, you know, what they perceived to be a kind of corruption and a kind of domination of power politics in favor of the interests of, say, crowns as opposed to the people, and they wanted no part of that. And so they saw a lot of the kind of getting involved, intervening in other countries' affairs as being a danger to our liberal democracy. But nowadays it's really shifted, and you see whether it's neoconservatives on the right or it's liberal internationalists on the left, right? Either a Bill Kristol on the right or Samantha Power or Anne-Marie Slaughter on the left, is that you see people who they want to get the United States actively engaged abroad, oftentimes with good intentions, right? They want to help out the people of Libya. That's what happened with that war that was promoted by people like Susan Rice and Samantha Power and others under the Obama administration. But the consequences were destructive of even those ends. And so I think a lot of it springs from this kind of kind of liberalism, this kind of also kind of like kind of quasi-religious motivation to remake the world and to make it better. And again, I can sympathize with that as a liberal broadly understood. The problem is that you have to have realism about the nature of the world and the constraints on being able to try to realize heaven on earth, to try to remake the world. And the problem is that too few people have understood those constraints. For example, the enemy gets a vote, right? You don't just get to impose your will on others without them responding. The fact that nationalism is a powerful force that will push back against you if you try to dominate. How the balance of power affects decisions and outcomes. These are all things that realists bring to bear to try to teach people, I think, about what the limits of our kind of oftentimes well-intentioned approaches abroad, what those can do. But the problem is that few people have loved a realist in this town, which is somewhat understandable given that if the United States was the unipolar power like it was after the end of the war, you can understand why we might get a little bit drunk on our own ambition, if you will. And what I think that is happening now is that we're seeing that we can't do anything we want without incurring costs, and now people are more interested in realism.
Well, I can't think of a better way, you know, a better ending to the show than to stop right here. We're almost out of time. But I also want to ask you if there's anything that you want to add. If you want to give us your website again so people can follow up with you. Is there anything that we should have asked that we didn't?
You could follow me at Will Ruger on Twitter. I like to put out some ideas as well as what other people are talking about in this vein. And I guess what I would say is that, the United States needs to have a foreign policy that defends us vigorously, and we need to have a military second to none. But we need to be much more cautious in how we use it, because we're not doing ourselves or our military service members or the people we're trying to help. We're not doing them favors if we're making mistakes because we're being too thoughtless, too messianic or too aggressive abroad in ways that actually hurt us. So I think I would always counsel for realism and restraint. And sometimes we have to use force like we did after 9/11 in Afghanistan. And sometimes when we do it, we make real mistakes like the Iraq War. And so I want to stop things like the Iraq War, ideally, from ever happening by helping promote and working with others to try to promote a different vision for American foreign policy.
Well, thank you so much. I think you've been an amazing guest, Dr. Ruger, I'm so happy that you came on, and I hope as things progress, you'll come back and talk to us. Maria, do you have something like that?
Yeah, I have three takeaways, Dr. Ruger. Your unnecessary and imprudent comment, your transpartisan approach comment, and your realism and restraint comment. Those, to me, that just covers it all and gives me a sense of serenity that we've got capable, bright hands that are helping to help this world be a better place. So thank you for your contribution to that.
Couldn't say
it any
better.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. And I think you're right on with those three things.
Well, thank you so much. And again, we hope you come back. And we're going to leave you with a song tonight. We usually leave and on a song. And this goes out to our guest. And it's the eternal question that I think we always ask. And we never actually get the complete answer to, but here's Peter, Paul, and Mary with Blowing in the Wind. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for your time, Dr. Ruger.
Very much so.
Give the people their right to vote.